You are listening to a podcast from West Hill United Church, located in Scarborough, Ontario, Canada. These podcasts are made possible by the generous support of our listeners, volunteers, and members of our community. To donate, go to our website, www.westhill.net, and click on the Canada Helps button, or go to westhill.net/donate.
To acknowledge that we are on the traditional territory of the Mississaugas of the New Credit First Nations lands, which lands were previously occupied by the Seneca and Huron-Wendat First Nations. No opening song. So welcome on this, last day of November. And it really hasn't been such a bad month after all, except for various afflictions that have fallen upon us. So if you are new in our congregation, I can't see too well with the light, but we do welcome anyone who comes by our door that likes to be surprised. And yes, we do have faces I don't recognize. I hope you enjoy your time with us and feel welcome to ask questions which you might not ask in any other church. And don't be surprised at some of the answers.
Many of you know that this Wednesday I'm at Unholy, which is Diane Flack's theater about women in religion. And it's a conversation supposedly that takes place for a YouTube channel with four women with different perspectives on their religious traditions. And it's a fiery, feisty conversation and a lovely, very important show, I think, for now. Diane has updated it a little bit, given the current context, since the last time the show ran. And after the show, I'll be having a conversation with the audience. So that's on Wednesday evening at 8 o'clock down at Buddy's in Bad Time Theater, if any of you want to join me for that. I know it wouldn't be a wasted evening.
Now we have two short readings this morning. One of the tasks of true friendship is to listen compassionately and creatively to the hidden silences. Often secrets are not revealed in words. They lie concealed in the silence between the words or in the depths of what is unsayable between two people. And that's written by John O'Donohue and M. Cara, offered as wisdom for the journey. Now the second reading was by A. E. Milne, who wrote Winnie the Pooh, who goes back many, many years. I read Winnie the Pooh when I was very, very young. "Rabbit's clever," said Pooh thoughtfully. "Yes," said Piglet, "rabbit's clever, and he has a brain." "Yes," said Piglet, "rabbit has brain." There was a long silence. "I suppose," said Pooh, "that's why he never understands anything." Offered as wisdom for the journey.
Anyone want to do the grounded guided growing today? Anyone have anything they want to add to that? Scott usually takes the microphone at this point in time and talks about some way in which during the week he's been grounded in the interconnectedness of life. I think virally he's very connected to the rest of the world this week, starting out with a stomach flu virus and now complementing it with a respiratory flu virus. So he's feeling very interconnected. Oh, interconnection, yes. I had dinner with Eleanor and Richard Camage this week, And it was lovely to be able to spend just a very relaxed evening with them on Thursday. On Friday, Eleanor phoned. I thought it was to tell me that I'd forgotten something at her house. But instead, she had received a phone call from a friend of hers in England, from Salisbury, someone who lived with Eleanor when she first came into the city. There was an Anglican home down on near Dundas and McCall, down by the Arts Centre. And they, the Anglican Church, this woman purchased a home because she felt that young women new to the city should be under some kind of supervision and in a safe place. So Eleanor lived there when she was working a little bit further up at College and Young. And her friend also lived there, and she had come over from England to spend a year just traveling around Canada, but she worked for a while here in Toronto, and so they became friends and have stayed friends all these many years. So her friend, I believe her name was Barbara, called her on Friday morning to tell her that she had had a phone call from a friend in Leeds. And the person in Leeds had told her about going to this event and hearing a woman from Canada talk about the original sort of work that she was doing in her congregation in Canada. And, of course, it was when Scott and I were in Leeds. And subsequent to that, she had a phone call from a friend in Birmingham who wanted to tell her that she had been at this event with this woman from Canada who was talking about the extraordinary work she was doing in this congregation in Canada. Of course, it was Scott and I in Birmingham. So both those, so she had heard from two people who were at these two events, and there weren't thousands of people at these events. These were, you know, fairly conservative numbers in terms of people. But they had both phoned Barbara, and Barbara immediately had known that it was Eleanor and Richard's minister who had been speaking, so she called. So that is an interconnectedness that was really lovely, and that drew them back together by telephone on Thursday. So thank you. That's, I think, all I'll share. We get much joy out of the people that with whom we have relationships that have developed over the many years. I know Ruth Noble had someone here who she's known since she was 5 or something a few weeks ago, and Martha has had extended friendships that go back through decades and decades, and so to be able to continue to converse about contemporary things after those long times together is certainly a gift for all of us. So thank you. Oh, we did the readings. All right. They usually come after this. Now we'll do the song, which we have rejigged to one that we think we can sing together.
Will you stand and join me, please? The only rejigging I ever do is just lowering the keys. This one, I'll sing the first couple lines. This is, you'll know, but for those who, I always make assumptions, we make assumptions that everybody knows this stuff, but we're going to just make sure that we do. This is the first two lines. It goes, open to all that I am, open to all I am not. Is that enough of a teaser? Well, it'll be a surprise when you get there. I'm going to make sure you don't drag. Ready, two, three, go. Open to all that I am, open to all I am not, open to seeking the truth I need. Truth can be found when it's sought. Spirit of truth, I am open to you. Though sometimes I hide, you won't be denied. Nourish me, challenge me, guide me today, and I will follow in your way. Open to all that I have, open to all I have not, open to giving what's hard to give. Truth gives what cannot be bought. Spirit of truth, I am open to you. Though sometimes I hide, you won't be denied. Nourish me, challenge me, guide me today, and I will follow in your way. Open to all that may happen, open to all that may not. open to learning what's hard to learn. Truth brings a freedom to thought. Spirit of truth, I am open to you. Though sometimes I hide, you won't be denied. Nourish me, challenge me, guide me today, and I will follow in your way. Very nice.
I think we need to get a phone so we can record the last one for Scott to listen to. Maybe we'll get some people to get their phones out when we get there. So as many of you know, I begin my work each week by reviewing the passages from the Bible that are in the lectionary for the coming year on this particular Sunday. So this particular Sunday, as the Sunday before the first Sunday of Advent, and everyone knows the four Sundays before Christmas are Advent, if only because your grandchildren eat chocolate for that period of time. The Sunday before that is really the end of the year, so the beginning of the end of the Christian year. The beginning of the Christian year starts on the first Sunday of Advent and goes through to this last Sunday, which is called Reign of Christ. And so all of the readings are about that story, that the telling of that truth within the Christian tradition. And as I was reading it, and, you know, they're very familiar texts to me. I've read them for decades and explored them in depth. So they're very familiar to me. But it occurred to me as I was reading them that they're used to create an interpretation that we would embrace, an interpretation of words or ideas that were formed a couple of thousand years ago. And I have a hard enough time explaining myself to someone right in front of me. So trying to get someone from way back there to explain whatever they were trying to say clear enough for us to get it clearly now seems a fool's errand. And so the theme for the day emerged, and that is to be understood. That is the challenge. The focus moment that I wrote, of course, pertains mostly to that story of how the story ended up being about the reign of Christ. These are wise and powerful words. They've stirred the hearts of generations, filled them with courage, fortitude, resolve. Inscribed on ancient tablets, scrolls, they yet find their way to kitchen and bedside tables, the podiums of scholars, the shrines of faith. How shall we read them? Do we pluck and parse them one by one, or pour them out fastened one to the other and seek for understanding through the in-betweens, the silent spaces never filled? We own this legacy of words handed to us generation after generation, and still, though we may say we know them, we cannot say we understand. For locked in any fine construal is the heart that dreamt a world unseen, and only these mere words to make it known. I think I had put it on mute when I was singing and I could hear myself over the PA system. I put it on mute at that point in time. So I was thinking about this to be understood and realized that it was maybe less the Reign of Christ texts that headed me in this direction than the fact that Scott was in the basement and I was at my computer on the first floor and we weren't talking to each other. Because we had just had one of those monumental misunderstandings. it wasn't what we were arguing about that was the issue, and it never is in our arguments. It's not what we're arguing about, though we'll have two different perspectives on anything. It's probably good he's not here, right? Because I could hear the accompaniment at this point. It's not what we're arguing about. It's that we get into that, well, wait a minute, that's not what you said. What do you mean that's not what I said? Well, what you said was this. No, that's what you heard. What I said was this. And we get into this fine-tuning of what it was that the other person said that we assumed that they meant, and what they meant, which may not have been what they said, but was really offered in a particular way that was seriously misconstrued. And that's really the pathway of any of our misunderstandings. It could be about, you know, where I'm supposed to be at dinner time, or what he's supposed to be doing on the third, you know, Friday of the month, or whatever the misunderstanding might be. It almost always ends up in this little parsing of the words and the facial expression and the harumph that is never really. Does anyone ever go harumph? No. But okay, I want you all at once. Let's do what the harumph is. Perfect. We all know that. We've all used it to dismiss someone else, to get our point across dully or bluntly. But that's how it goes, is that little bit of misunderstanding. And it's probably because both of us use words. I mean, I'm a communicator, so I assume that I am clearly expressing what it is that I'm saying. And then I have to deal with the fact that he too is a communicator. That's what he does in his work, is he communicates. So clearly, he can't be that, you know, unschooled in the art. So there has to be something happening in between that is going on. So I think when I read The Reign of Christ, I was going, how could you possibly understand this stuff, right? And it may have had more to do with what was happening on the first floor in the basement at the time than what someone was trying to dream up 2,000 years ago to explain something that had been going on in their life that they felt was so crucial for us to understand, that they put it together in a way that surely we would get. But the volumes and volumes and volumes of exegesis, the work of taking those pieces of scripture apart, word by word at times, not just the whole piece, but word by word or verse by verse or chapter by chapter, the volumes that would fill libraries are innumerable. And so it's very unlikely that we could say we know what that person meant back then. Particularly when we are so poor at knowing what it is the person in front of us is trying to convey. So as I began looking for what I would explore this topic with this time, because I'm quite certain I've explored it many times before, that how to be understood and how to not be misunderstood and how to have conversation, I came across a piece that had been recently posted by Saham Farouk on a website called Medium. And it was his article was called On the Inadequacies of Language. And one of the very first lines caught my eye because it was so beautifully put. And he said, maybe one of the most tragic love stories is between language and the need for meaningful communication. That somewhere in between, those two things really never make it work perfectly. That we're always falling short on something, the tragic love story of language and what it is we need to communicate. And so, of course, I was drawn in immediately to his essay and to the exploration of it. And then, of course, I responded to what he had to say, and then he responded saying that he wasn't quite sure what I understood, but he thought what I was saying was blah, blah, blah. And then I responded, so just like Scott and I. And I am the single common denominator in that those two particular things, but you are a common denominator in a whole lot of those situations in your own lives. And so that's why this has relevance for us as humans as we seek to come to understand one another. So when it comes to our scriptural heritage, one of the things that you hear a lot about on certain radio stations at this time of year has to do with the person called Mary. And what is the single most known thing about Mary that we share at this time of year, that Mary was a virgin. That's right. Okay, so Mary was a virgin, which isn't true, right? It isn't true. The virgin is, as many of you know, a translation of the Hebrew word for a young woman. And that it was translated as virgin in the King James Bible started that whole understanding of the miraculous birth. Now, many will argue and say that, well, of course it had to be a virgin birth because we were proving that this person was God. And as many, many, many God stories in the world's histories have the God born of a virgin, or this blessed person born of a virgin, so too Jesus had to have been born of a virgin. And so that was the original intent. We don't really know that. It was a young woman. In the Islamic tradition, there's a story told, and Saham tells it in his essay, that when Mary finds out that she's carrying this child, she is under a tree just wailing and lamenting that she would be ignored by everyone, that no one would ever see her or know her rather than her having to tell this tale. And he argues that that's because, you know, it's going to be really difficult for her to explain to everybody that she's pregnant, but she's still a virgin. Well, the reality is that it might have not been a good thing to tell anyone that you were pregnant, even if it wasn't a virgin birth at that point in time, because being pregnant when you were unmarried in most of our cultures has not been acceptable up until the 1980s when the other Madonna made it possible with Papa Don't Preach and opened up the possibility for millions of unwed women to carry their children to term and keep their babies rather than give them up for adoption. And so it's not necessary that she have been a virgin for it to have been a terrible situation as they unfold it in the Islamic understandings of that story. But that one single piece of information, that there was a mistranslation into the English, is one that, you know, helps that whole house of cards end up on the table and have to be spread out so that we can figure out exactly what it means. And we've been at that work for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years. And there are still incredible minds putting themselves to that work. My deepest hope is that some of those minds start putting themselves to the work of global climate change or the sequestering of carbon in our oceans and things that will actually make the future better for generations to come, and that we can move away from trying to reparse these words in ways to help somebody finally understand them properly, because we need to understand ourselves and our situations most urgently. So Farouk goes on and he talks about the three things that happen that make it difficult for the words, for what it is that we seek to express, to get across to someone else. And one of them, the first thing, is that we encrypt what it is that we're trying to say with words, right? We encrypt it with words. And so that as soon as we try to put something, our experience, which may not have words that can describe it well, or we may not have the vocabulary that can get that across well, so we're putting our experience into these words and trying to share them with someone else. So that's the first thing that happens. Then there's the medium, the properties of the medium that we're sharing it through, that how we get transmit those words is another barrier. If it's not done cleanly and in a way that the other person is going to receive it the way we meant it, then it's going to get distorted along the way. And then the other one is the, what's it called? Decryption? Is that what it's called? When you unlock the code, you know, the other person gets it, and it's not called decryption. Yeah, it is, decryption. They take it apart and decrypt it, and then they take those words into themselves, and they try to understand what it is you mean. So there's three areas where we can get seriously messed up. One of the ones that Farouk didn't go on about these, but I started to explore them myself. So the encryption one, English is a challenging language to speak in, because it's sort of an amalgam of two major root languages, one the Germanic languages and the other are French languages that came through the Normans. So we have, I don't know, compared to other languages in the world, but we have so many synonyms, it's remarkable. And the words that we use to express ourselves come from one of those two different roots. So I wrote some down here. So there's folk and people, right? Want and desire, buy and purchase, understand, comprehend, needs, requirements, woods, forest, gift, present, thought and idea. And they all mean the same things, right? Like that each of them means the same thing as the other one. But listen to this. Folk want to buy. Folk want to buy. Folk want to buy. Okay? Now, you got this picture of somebody who's saying, folk want to buy. And then you have a picture of someone saying, people desire to purchase. Two different people? Like, have you gotten an assumption about what each one of them is already, just simply by the words that came out of their mouth? Right? So encryption tells us a lot about the person. It tells us probably more than we really are even aware of as we listen to someone speak to us and we make assumptions about the words that they're using and who they are because of which words they choose to use. Hoity-toity, or just one of the people, or one of the people and those scum, right? Like, from your perspective, we assume what people are because of the language that they use. We make particular choices and thoughts about them. We slander them with our own interpretation of the language that they use. Did anyone hear the piece on CBC about swearing? Emma Burke, I think, is a woman whose book is about swearing, and you know, there's scientific stuff that they're finding out about swearing and how they've looked at chimpanzees and they find that they, you know, use expletives in exactly the same way, only they throw their feces is really what they do. And when they're angry with someone, they throw their feces at them. But if they're potty trained, as many chimpanzees are, particularly if there are communities that are being watched and we're trying to learn things about them, when they're potty trained, they start making this, they make the same sign, right, that shows that they're angry. And they use that sign even if they're alone. If they get frustrated about something, they use that sign. I don't know whether they throw their feces at themselves if they're frustrated, but they use that sign as though being angry and using some kind of way to express it is good. And then they've done these tests with humans, and they've put their hands in ice-cold water. And they're told they need to use a particular language when their hands are in the water. They're supposed to say, oh, this is so cold, this is so cold, I can't stand it, this is so cold, this is so cold. Oh, this is so cold. And they time how long they can do that. And then they put their hands in ice-cold water and they tell them they can just swear a blue streak. And they can hold their hands in the ice-cold water almost 50% longer when they're swearing. Like, because it has this therapeutic, cathartic effect, right? So if they hold their hands, like, so if you're swearing, it can actually be a good thing. She goes on to say that swearing all the time can maybe be a bit of a problem, only because it normalizes that language, and then you have to find something else in order to get that same cathartic effect. So, you know, use it in a choice manner. My mother's favorite word was fishtails. Did any of you have mothers who said fishtails? No. I think she just made that up. And it wasn't until I was probably in my 40s that I heard what she was replacing with the word fishtails come out of her mouth. But I don't know whether she would have been able to hold her hand in ice water saying fishtails over and over again. But I don't think I would have been able to. So the language that we use has a lot to do with our getting our point across. So then when it comes to the medium, and we really have two ways of getting our point across verbally. There's lots of ways that we get our point across other ways, and that's, we did the humph earlier, one of them, our body language, rolling our eyes, which I'm horribly guilty of on a regular basis. My MP, Selena Cesar-Chavanez, had to be moved. Her seat was fairly close to Pierre Trudeau's in the House, and they had to move it because she would go And so she was caught a couple of times on film, so they moved her somewhere else where she wouldn't regularly be seen rolling her great big expressive eyes. I thought that was a lovely story. But we have lots of ways that we communicate non-verbally. But when we're trying to use words, when we're trying to get those words across, we mostly do it in a spoken way or in a written way. And sometimes when we can't do it in a spoken way, if we're not getting our point across, we will do it in other ways. We'll write it down. We'll go to email and we'll send an email that's this long explaining why we were right. You know, who's accused? Yeah, have you ever done that? Okay, this is why I'm right. Now that you see it in print, you'll understand, won't you? Another way that if we don't get our point across verbally, we choose to stop talking entirely, which is, again, another form of communication. We just become silent and we retreat and we don't talk. But when it comes to using words verbally, there are still obstacles to those words getting across in the way that we want them to get across. And because there are so many different ways in which we use words. And so some of the ones that I'm thinking are weekly when I write my focus moment, I don't share it with Scott. Because when I do share it with Scott, he sits there and goes, poetry is just not his form. Doesn't get it at all. And it really bugs me when he goes, I don't know what you mean. Because when I write it, it just comes, right? I haven't had to sit down and parse it and figure it out and tell. So when he says, what does it mean? I have to go back and say, that means, you know, like it's not a, poetry is more of a, I don't know, it just comes out, right? And so someone who doesn't get poetry won't get it if you're speaking or writing poetically. Technical language, which is used in almost any discipline, there's a level of technical language that's beyond what the layperson can absorb. And so there's lots of articles that if I pick them up and try to read them, I have no idea what they're talking about. It could be, you know, it has to do with physics, or it has to do even some theological language that I can't get my head around, or philosophy, or, you know, whatever, plumbing. Some of those things that you get, like I have to fix a toilet tomorrow, and the information that came in that seal thing that I have to do is so cryptic, I have no idea. If anyone wants to come and help me replace the toilet this afternoon, I would be much appreciative. But we don't, technical stuff, if we're not ensconced in that discipline, that technical language is probably beyond us. So often that doesn't get to us either. So that is... the problem of the medium, getting the medium across. And then there's the way that we share it, and that's if we're talking to someone, there are a variety of ways that we can share it. Okay, there's whispered, there's spoken. Okay, here's my sentence. I've never seen you like this before. I've never seen you like this before. Okay? Well, if I whisper that, I've never seen you like this before. Okay, I'm going to make my eyebrow go too. I've never seen. Totally different from, I've never seen you like this before, right? So I'm saying exactly the same thing, but the medium is slightly different. So you get a very different response from the person using that different medium, because you can whisper it, or you can say it in a normal voice, or you can yell it, or you can, you know, not say anything at all and leave. And then slow or fast, if you're giving them the information in a very quick way, or if you're saying it very slowly, okay, I'm going to whisper it again. I've never seen you like this before. Or, I've never seen you like this before. We can do a lot with just one sentence, fast, slow, loud, quiet. There's all kinds of things that we can do. And this is where the whole thing about swearing comes in as well. If we're punctuating everything we're saying with some kind of expletive, and I'm not going to do that with that sentence, whispering it, you can imagine that yourself. But we bring a whole different tone into the story that we're trying to say. And then we get to this part about decryption. And this is probably the most difficult piece to get through, because we lose control of it. We can manage the words and the choice of the words that we use. We can manage the tone. We can manage, you know, the accessibility of the language. We can manage the medium to a certain degree. And we'll get a lot of what we're trying to say across through those things. But then we have to let it go. Because then it is being absorbed into someone else whose life we haven't lived, whose language we don't use, not because it's a different language in terms of English or Latin or there is no Latin spoken anymore, English and Spanish or, you know, any other language, but because they use language differently than we do, and they have all their lives. And also because our world experience is totally different. So those things in one book that Scott and I read earlier on in our relationship was about the gears in each of us. And I'm sure I've mentioned this before, that something that has, you know, a little gear in me might catch a cog of something that is a huge gear in Scott, or vice versa. It's mostly vice versa, that he has little cogs and they send big things and send me going, because my life experience is very different from his life experience. I'm working through with one of the members of my family now that we have this way of responding. When someone says something that is emotionally challenging to us, we just shut down. You know, we don't argue with them. We don't try to express our own perspective. We don't try to say, but that's not the way I see it. We just shut down. We take it as this enormous assault upon who we are, and we shut down. And that has cost me dearly through my life. And I'm only just figuring out that there are other responses to that, even though I haven't quite been able to get to the place where I can use those responses. But I'm learning that there are tools that I could pick up and try to respond. We have ways that we deal with things that other people say to us that can enrich the conversation and keep it going, or that can completely shut it down or send us off on another track. So we can encrypt what it is that we want to say. We can share it as beautifully as we might choose to do so, and still it might falter in the understanding, because the person that we're trying to reach doesn't have the same tools that we have, doesn't have the same language, can't embrace what it is we're offering. Now, my newfound online friend, Saham Farouk, then went into the place where he talked about God as a black box. And as a person of faith, he argued that the best that we can do is to offer that over to God and assume that God is going to work that wonder that will make it known to the person on the other side of the conversation. This is not a worldview that I hold. But he was asking, can we live with that? Can we live with the unknown, or with the faith that God will make that understood to the other person? Is that good enough for us? And I responded saying that my construct of God has only really been useful to me when I think of God as many people do, as an all-knowing being. So as a construct, by which I mean it's not something that I think is really there, but that doesn't mean I can't use it as a construct in my own understanding. So if I think that there's this being that understands absolutely everything about me, then I have nothing that I can hide from that being. So if in conversation I were to use that construct, and in sort of the way that Saham was suggesting it, then I would be putting out there what that all-knowing God could see as truthfully me, and then share that going forward. He hadn't suggested the truthfully me part. But if, before I speak, I take the time to follow all the paths that led to that moment, go back and find out where they came from, what the history was, where the hurts and the joys and the celebrations and the things that I think are normal came from. If I can go back into all of that and then back into the why I want to say it, where is this coming from? What is it I'm really trying to do here? Am I trying to gain some power over this person? Am I trying to create a relationship that can go forward together stronger than I would be if I was trying to do this myself? Are we in a partnership here, or am I trying to come in and ask for that person's approval? What's the why of what I want to say? If I can lay bare myself, as I would under that all-knowing God construct, if there is nothing that I can hide, and I'm as honest as I possibly can be about that, there's no guarantee that that's going to get where I want it to go and still be completely understood, but it's going to have a lot better chance of it. And if I have opened myself raw to my own understanding of what it is I'm trying to say, and I'm not trying to prove the other person had, really, that's not what you meant. If I'm not trying to prove that, I'm trying to find out why I'm trying to prove that and what the impetus to my being right is and what it is I really could set aside because it keeps me from seeing who I really am, even that me that I don't like very much. If I'm able to get beyond all that, then I think we could end up maybe not on two floors of a house, but having a conversation. And I could model, not necessarily for Scott because he's really good at this and doesn't need a model, but I could model that honesty that real communication requires, a gut-wrenching honesty that tells me who I am every time I open my mouth. I think that we live in a world that is so fragmented and so built upon the perspectives that we have of other people and the assumptions and our placing of ourselves within an order that has been established long before us but is constantly shifting and changing. And I think, too, that some of the challenges that face our youth are so deeply related to the creation of new configurations in that status world that is so tied to phones and tablets and social media that we lose a sense of who we are. We lose the capacity to understand ourselves, to talk about what it is that hurts and understand it so well that we can actually end up in a real conversation. And so our children are filled with anxiety in that new world, one that we navigated with confidence and found our anxieties in other places as we aged. But I think that conversation and these learning to encrypt in ways that are as honest and open as we possibly might be, that's the gift that we have to offer one another. And it will turn itself only and ever into a gift to ourselves as well, as we navigate that reality of creating relationships and being present to our families, to our children, to our friends, to the world, in ways that can be true to who we are, and so invite them in turn to be true to who they are with us. So encrypting and presenting and decryption, may it be for us a practice that becomes intentional and careful and considered, and may we find ourselves engaged deeply and truly with one another. Thank you. So I have a little exercise for you to do with this. And that is, I often talk about putting our words of commitment up beside your bathroom mirror and looking at it in the morning and thinking, okay, what's my day and how can I bring these values into my day? And then at night, standing in front of that mirror again and going, did I do that? Yes, I did that well, or I could have done this a little bit better. And there, that it forms a kind of ritual of prayer that some of us have been involved in all our lives. Well, I want you to use that mirror in a different way in the next little while. And you can use a crayon or lipstick or eyeliner or whatever you want to do. And when you stand in front of that mirror, and you may share a mirror with someone, in which case I invite you to just use one side and not read what ends up on the other side. I want you to write down what you see. Who do you see? Who are you? And when you look in that mirror really and truly, if there was that construct of God staring at you, what would it see if you had nothing to hide? Write that, or if you couldn't hide anything, not that you had nothing to hide, but that everything you had was unhidden. Write down who you are. And maybe the other person can write down the other side. You might want to tape a piece of paper towel or something over it. I don't know, if you don't want to share it. But if you are in relationship with someone, I invite you to at some point share those lists. Be honest with one another about what's on those lists. And be vulnerable with one another in hearing what's on those lists. So if I write conscientious and I share that with Scott and he holds that for some time, I know he will be able to give me a richer understanding of that. Not that he'll see me exactly the same way I am or say, yes, you are, honey. But that he'll bring me a richer understanding that will challenge me to be that in a better way or in a more honest way. And I'm inviting you to do that with someone. Now, you may not live with somebody who can do that with you, but we're in groups together with people here, or are there other people in your lives that you've known for a long time that you could trust doing that? And just see how glaring that truth might be and how important it may be to hear what someone else has to offer about it. And Scott is a social worker, so if it leads to some really difficult stuff and you need to deal with something in a relationship, go to him. Yeah. No, I'm happy to have those conversations with you, but I think that it would be... I think we too rarely are completely honest with ourselves about who we are and what would be revealed if it was all revealed. I think that's an important undertaking to do. So there you go. That's homework. All right, up, and we're listening to Scott play the piano, and then we're going to sing a song. Often people talk about Sunday best, about bringing the best, you know, wearing your good smile and coming from your home with a white picket fence and making sure everyone knows it has a white picket fence. And really the truth is there's no such thing as a white picket fence. We can be who we are here, because every single person in this place would give you the space to be who you are. And we aren't that as completely as we'd like to be, because we often are afraid to trust that. And I think that trust begins with trusting ourselves to know who we are and having the courage to hold that, even when we don't like some of it. And so finding our way toward trusting ourselves will help us find our way toward trusting others and having those conversations that create the relationships that buoy us and challenge us and change us. And if that's not what we're about, I don't know what we're about. I think that we do that, and despite the fact that I think we do it better than almost anybody I know, I think we could do it better. We always could. So go out into that great world that will engage with you and find you in that engagement and bring that you back here, that we might celebrate it all. And now let us sing our song.
Oh, may this be the guide in my life. May this be my wisdom, true compassion, deep respect, given from a heart of love. True compassion, deep respect, given from a heart of love.
You have been listening to a podcast from West Hill United Church located in Scarborough, Ontario, Canada. These podcasts are made possible by the generous support of our listeners, volunteers, and members of our community. To donate, go to our website, www.westhill.net, and click on the Canada Helps button, or go to www.westhill.net/donate.